Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's event, part of the Innovating California series sponsored by Chevron. My name is Russ Yarrow, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, manager of public affairs at Chevron, and your chair for the evening. It is my pleasure to introduce Sal Khan tonight, founder of the Khan Academy and author of the One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. The Khan Academy's mission is to provide free, world-class education for everyone, anywhere, anytime. Founded only 5 years ago, the Academy has grown to be the most used library of education videos on the web, with over 8 million viewers using over 4,000 lessons ranging from organic chemistry to physics and history. Accessed in over 30,000 classrooms in more than 200 countries around the world, tutorial lessons are also available in over 25 different languages. Sal was born and raised in Louisiana to immigrant parents from India and Bangladesh. He earned 3 degrees in mathematics, electrical engineering, and computer science from MIT and an MBA from Harvard. No underachiever is Sal Khan. Sal has worked as a hedge fund analyst and was an engineer at Oracle and several other Silicon Valley startups. And last year, as many of you know, Time magazine named Sal one of the 100 most influential people in the world. At my company, we believe the kind of work that Sal is doing is important, because a strong educational system is truly a tide that lifts all boats. Education is one of the primary levers for building healthy societies and strong economies. And at Chevron, it's one of the core focus areas of our social investments. Over the past 3 years, we've invested around $100 million in education, and with our partners, those programs have reached about 500,000 students in classrooms across America. We do this because we believe the runway for innovation in education is wide and long, and people like Sal Khan are beacons on that runway. So please, everyone, join me in welcoming Sal Khan.
It's exciting to be here. So I like to start these things really just understanding how familiar all of you are with Khan Academy. So I'll start with how many of your children or either if you are a student or you have children who use Khan Academy? How many? Oh, it's a good number. Oh, very good. And how many of you are at least familiar with it in some way, shape, or form? Okay. And how many of you have no idea what Khan Academy is? Good. Okay. I'll focus on the few of you because we'll make this more productive. So as was introduced, Khan Academy is most known for this collection of videos that I started making for my cousins. But as we'll see over the course of this session, we think it's really just a small part of what we are. And there's a lot of interactivity and software and all the rest. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But to get everyone on the same page of what at least these videos look like, I'll start with this montage.
We could integrate over the surface, and the notation usually is a capital sigma. All of these interactions are just due to the gravity over interstellar, or almost you could call it intergalactic. This animal's fossils are only found in this area of South America, a nice clean band here. Notice this is an aldehyde, and it's an alcohol. Is there $30 million plus the $20 million from the American manufacturer? They create the Committee of Public Safety, which sounds like a very nice committee.
This is not Eve.
No, Botticelli's portrayed the ancient goddess of love.
This is 6 × 6 × 6, or 216.
I'm told the humidity makes it feel hotter. Why is this?
Excellent question, LeBron.
Let's just, like, make it 11.
Play with the pendulum and get a feel for how it moves.
Function as a bridge rectifier.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
If this does not blow your mind, then you have no emotion.
I always like a crowd that appreciates Euler's identity, so y'all are doing. So just to give a snapshot of where Khan Academy is now, and some of this was covered in the introduction, we are in 30,000 classrooms. It's being used in practically every country in the world. We just crossed 8 million registered users. It looks like this month we're on track for about 10 million unique users. And they've done over 1.2 billion problems. And we'll talk about what those problems are in a little bit. But before going into that, I'll talk a little bit about how all of this started, because it's, at least been for me, it's been a bit of a strange journey. And it's kind of fun to be here, because a lot of this journey took place in the apartment that we were renting literally across the street from here on El Camino. So it's a very local story. If we rewind back to 2004, I was a year out of business school. I was working as an analyst at a small hedge fund. It was myself, my boss, and his dog. And the dog was the chief economist. And I had just gotten married, and my family was visiting Boston from New Orleans. That's where I was born and raised as well. And as part of that, when they were visiting, it just came out of conversation that one of my cousins, Nadia, who was 12 years old at the time, was having trouble with math, and it was placing her into a slower math class. And so I chatted with her and found out that it was all about unit conversion. That's what she was having trouble with. I offered to tutor her when she went back to New Orleans. She agreed. And so for the next month or so, this was August of 2004, we got on the phone every evening, chatted with her, tried to understand where she was. And, you know, it was slow going in the beginning, but she eventually caught up with her class. Then she actually got a little bit ahead of her class. And at that point, I became what I call a tiger cousin. And I called up her school, and I said, you know, I really think Nadia Rahman should retake the placement exam from last year. They said, who are you? I said, I'm her cousin. So quite surprisingly, they did let her take that placement exam. And then she was kind of, you know, off and frankly doing better than any of us had expected. And I was kind of hooked. I was able to help my cousin get her help her get on a good trajectory. So I started working with her younger brothers. And then my boss's wife accepted a position as a professor at Stanford Law School. So we moved the whole firm over from Boston. That's literally when my wife and I, we moved. There's a little condominium across the street here, right next to Sushi Tomo and that Starbucks right there. And it's important to visualize all of this. And several things had happened as part of that transition. About 18 months, 2 years had passed. The first was that word got around in the family that free tutoring was going on. And so I found myself with 10, 15 cousins, family, friends, every day after work. I was getting on the phone, having conference calls. I was also using Yahoo Doodle at the time so that we could see each other's writing. The other thing that I started working on, and this was actually the first incarnation of Khan Academy, it had absolutely nothing to do with videos, is I saw that they needed practice on a lot of things. And instead of having to point them to a million different web pages and not knowing what they were working on, I started to write these little widgets for them so that they could get practice problems, they could see the steps if they were confused, that I, as their tutor, could keep track of what they were working on, what they needed help on. And it was around that time, this is now fall of 2006, I was at a friend's birthday party in San Mateo, and most of the guests had left, and all my friends knew that I had this crazy project. I was tutoring all of these cousins, and I was writing this software, and I was kind of showing it off to my friends, this thing I'd been working on. And that's the first time I called it Khan Academy, really almost as a joke. It's like, you know, the whole thing is me. And one of my friends, Zulfikar Ramzan, said, oh, you know, this is really cool, Sal, but my question is, how are you scaling yourself? There's no way you can do with 15 cousins what you used to do with just Nadia. And I said, no, I completely agree. It's actually a problem. I often wish that Sasha was around when I answered that question for Armand, or that they had some way, you know, that they had more access to me. And Zuli said, well, you know, I have a simple idea. Why don't you make some of your lessons as videos and upload them to YouTube? And I said, no, that's a horrible idea. YouTube is for cats playing piano, not serious mathematics. But I went home that weekend, got over the idea that it wasn't my idea, and I decided to give it a shot. And Those first few videos were in pre-algebra, basic algebra type things. I told my cousins, hey, why don't you watch this if you have any questions? Obviously, we'll still have our tutorial sessions so that you can ask me any questions that go beyond the videos. And after a couple of months of this, I asked them what they thought, and they somewhat famously and backhandedly told me that they liked me better on YouTube than in person. And I've analyzed that a little bit more, and I think it's clear what they were saying and what they weren't saying. What they were saying is it is true. They did appreciate having an on-demand version of an explanation in the privacy of their home whenever they wanted to, with no judgment, no expectation, versus having to get explained the first time by me. And even if I'm not trying to sound judgmental, they're afraid, am I wasting Sal's time? Or maybe I'm embarrassed that I'm in ninth grade and I have to review some basic mathematics. But what they weren't saying is that they didn't appreciate me in their life. They still liked me taking interest in what they were doing. They still liked me mentoring them. They still liked me answering their questions. So I took it as positive feedback, kept making more and more and more and more videos. And then it became clear, this is probably spring of 2007, that people who were not my cousins were watching. And at first, I just saw the view count start to go up slowly at first, but it kept growing and growing. Then the comments started to come in, and some of the comments were literally a simple thank you. And even that was pretty special. I don't know how much time you've spent on YouTube, but most of the comments are not thank you. They're a little bit more colorful than that. And so I kept going and going, and then the comments got more intense. This is the reason why I was able to pass algebra. This is the reason after retiring from the military I could go back and get my college diploma. I remember in those early days I got a letter, and I literally brought my wife over to read it. It was kind of so profound and moving. A mother whose sons had learning disabilities, and she wrote how this was the only thing that was connecting with them, and the ability to do things over and practice things. And she said, she finished the letter saying, my entire family prays for your entire family every night. And you have to put things in perspective from my point of view. I was an analyst at a hedge fund. I wasn't used to people praying for me. Or at least in that way. So it was kind of heady stuff. And so you fast forward all the way to 2009, and by this point the viewership had grown so much. I was getting so many of these letters. I'd set it up as a not-for-profit, and, I set it up as a not-for-profit in 2008, not quite thinking that this is what I was going to do for a living anytime soon, but then by 2009, it had just overtaken my life in a lot of ways, and so, my wife and I, we looked at our budget, and we had some savings, really saving up for a house out here, which is no small feat, and we said, well, I don't think it's crazy, you could try this for a year, we could live off of savings for a little bit. And so I decided to take the plunge. And I think like a lot of these, startup entrepreneurial stories, this is obviously in the not-for-profit sector, but it's very similar to the for-profit sector. You start with a very naive point of view. You say, oh, well, this is a great idea. Look how many people are using it. Look at these letters. I literally used to go with a notebook of testimonials from folks, and I started pitching it to foundations and philanthropists. And it took me a couple of months to realize that actually I was being naive, that it was actually hard to get traction. People really didn't know what to think of this organization that was literally a guy operating out of his closet. And you fast forward about 9 months, and I started to get pretty insecure, pretty stressed. There were moments where I was updating my resume, maybe having to go back to what I was doing before. And it was right around that time that a $10,000 donation came in. And I see who it is. Her name was Ann Doerr. She's based in Palo Alto, so I immediately email her and I say, thank you very much. This is the largest donation that Khan Academy has ever received. If we were a physical school, you would not have a building named after you. And Anne immediately emails back. She's like, oh, well, I spent a lot of time on your site. It's been helping my daughters. A lot of the kids at my daughter's school use it. I'd love to learn more about what you're doing. And so the next week we meet at an Indian buffet restaurant in downtown Palo Alto, and she asks, well, what's your goal here? And I told her, well, when you fill out to get not-for-profit status with the IRS, they have literally a little part of the form. It's like mission, colon, and then like a line and a half. And I said, well, I filled that out, and I wrote a free world-class education for anyone anywhere. And Ann said, well, that's ambitious. How do you see yourself going about that? And I told her, I was like, look, you know, this is a mission. You know, I don't think that anytime soon I'm just going to be able to check it off and move on to healthcare or something. But I think we can make a lot of progress. I want to keep making videos. We could get other people to make videos. We can translate the videos into the world's languages. But more than videos, that's just part of the solution. We need some way for people to get interactivity, to get feedback, some way to empower the other stakeholders in a student's learning, the teachers, the parents, the peers. And so I showed Anne some of these screenshots of this software that I had been working on since 2005, really the original Khan Academy. And Anne said, you know, it's kind of surprising, but you've actually made a lot of progress with you know, what seems like very few resources. I only have one question. How are you supporting yourself? And in as proud of a way as possible, I said, I'm not. And so, you know, Anne kind of processes that, and we part ways. And literally 10 minutes later, and by this point, my son had just been born. We had just started renting a house in Mountain View, which is where I live now. I was driving into my driveway, and I got a text message from Anne. And it said, you really need to be supporting yourself. I've just wired you $100,000. So that was a good day. And frankly, things got crazier and crazier and crazier since then. And some of this, some of y'all might have read about it or whatever. A month later, I was running this little summer camp. It was actually at a middle school in Portola Valley. I was kind of this virtual teaching guy, and I was always curious, well, if you can do a lot of this stuff virtually, that opens up the physical classroom to do even deeper engagement, to do more simulations and projects and peer-to-peer tutoring. And so I had a bunch of middle school students. I was doing a simulation where I had 6 of them playing a game of Risk, and then I had the other 20 trading securities based on the outcome of the game of Risk. Very good game. And while that was happening, I start getting text messages from Anne, which you can imagine I now take very seriously. And they were actually really hard to read. They were somewhat cryptic, but they read along the lines of at the Aspen Ideas Festival, in the main pavilion, Bill Gates on stage, last 10 minutes talking about Khan Academy. So I didn't know what to make of this. I immediately boot the nearest 7th grader off of a computer, and I start looking for evidence of this thing that Anne is talking about. And I find it. People are tweeting about it, writing about it. I eventually find the actual video of the presentation. Literally, Walter Isaacson on stage with Bill Gates. He asks Bill Gates what he's excited about, and he says, oh, there's this site, Khan Academy. I use it with my kids. I use it myself. And when I saw that, it was this mixture of excitement on one side and then fear on the other. Those videos were for Nadia, not Bill Gates. And then I went home and I was actually just confused what I should do next. You know, what's the protocol here? Do I call him? I'm assuming he's not listed. And they left me like that for the next 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, I'm about to record a video, and then my cell phone rings. I see it says Seattle, Washington. I answer, hello? And this is Larry Cohen. I'm Bill Gates' chief of staff. You might have heard that Bill's a fan. Yeah, I heard that. If you're free in the next few weeks, we would love to fly you up to Seattle and find out how we might be able to work together or support Khan Academy. And I was looking at my calendar for the month at the moment, completely blank. And so I said, yeah, you know, I've got to cut my nails and do some laundry, but, you know, other than that, I think I can meet Bill Gates. And so we had the meeting, and I frankly told them the same things that I told Anne. At around that time, some folks from Google also reached out, asked very similar questions, told them the same thing. And so by fall of 2010, we got our first significant funding from the Gates Foundation and Google to actually find an office space, start hiring up a team. And what we started working on was really the original dream of Khan Academy. Not just videos. Videos are only part of it. But really interactive software and keeping track of data to really personalize things for students and make sure they master concepts before moving on. And what you see here, this is what we call our knowledge map. And it's part of the interface of Khan Academy. And but it also kind of it's a visual depiction of how we think about at least learning math. And eventually, you saw the videos go well beyond it. And right now, the math is where we have the most interactive content. But eventually, we want to expand that to much more, many more topics. But the general idea here is that the top nodes are very basic mathematics. And as you go further and further down, it gets into more advanced math. And as you show proficiency in basic math, it pushes you ahead to more and more advanced things. Just as how you would, if you were in a martial art, you learned the yellow belt or the white belt exam, then you go to yellow belt. Then you pass that, you go to green belt. But what we point out is that this is not the way that a traditional school model works. A traditional school model, we group kids together, usually by age. We move them together at a set pace. And then the narrative of the classroom is lecture in the classroom, and then you do some problem sets at home. That continues lecture, homework for a couple of weeks. And then the teacher gives a test. And let's say the test is on basic exponents. And on that test, I might get an 80%, you might get a 95%, you might get an 85%. And even though that test identified weaknesses, even the 95% student didn't know 5% of the material, the class then moves on to the next subject, usually a more advanced one, negative exponents or logarithms. And to kind of point out the absurdity of that, imagine if we did other things in our life that way. Say, home building. So you get the contractor in, and you say, we've got 3 weeks to build the foundation. Do what you can. So the contractor comes in. Maybe it rains. Maybe the supplies don't show up. They do their best. The inspector comes 3 weeks later, says, well, you know, the concrete's still wet around there. That part's not quite up to code. I would give it an 80%. You say, oh, great, that's a C. Let's build the first floor. Same process, 2 weeks, do what you can, 75%. Second floor, same thing, third floor, fourth floor. And then all of a sudden the whole building collapses. And if your reaction to that is the same reaction we often have in education, like, oh, maybe we had a bad contractor. Or maybe we needed more inspection, or the inspection wasn't good enough. But the reality was that the real problem was the process. You were artificially constraining how much time you had. That was pretty much ensuring that you have variable outcomes. Then you were ignoring those variable outcomes, you were ignoring those deficiencies, and then building on top of those, pretty much ensuring that you had these foundational gaps. And so what we say is, instead of holding fixed how long you have, and the variable is how well you learn it, do it the other way around. What should be fixed is that everyone should get the A level in and basic exponents, and then the variable is how long you have to learn it and when you learn it. And to get an idea of what this experience is like, and a lot of this is stuff that we've actually just launched in the last few weeks to really get at the heart of personalized learning. If you go to Khan Academy tonight, log in, all of this is free, you'll have a pretest. And that pretest is really trying to gauge where you are in mathematics. And that grid on the top will fill in as you do the pretest and as you do more activity. And the deepness of the blue in each of those squares, each square represents one of those concepts on the knowledge map. And the deeper the blue, it shows the more that you've mastered that actual content. And it isn't just mastering it once by getting 5 in a row. It'll later give you kind of the reviews. It'll make sure that you're mixing it in with different types of problems so that you also know when and how to apply the concepts. And in terms of the content focus, the Common Core has obviously been adopted in many states, including California. And we're working with the architects of the Common Core, with education experts, to make sure that we're actually a deep and substantive implementation. A standard is great, but what matters a lot is how that standard is expressed. And what we're trying to do is really make the best implementation of the Common Core. And between the items that we're writing with content experts, like the folks here, we're also partnering with the folks at Phillips Andover. That's, you know, the school where the AP test was invented. We're working on AP calculus with them to make sure that we really have, as our mission says, world-class content, so that people can feel confident that what they're getting here is as good as the assessment, the practice, the feedback that they would get anywhere. And to get a sense of what some of these exercises look like, this is kind of the type of exercise that we aspire all of our exercises to be, and ones that are in line with the Common Core. Here, this is a student trying to appreciate that the volume of a figure really can be thought of as the number of unit cubes that fit in that figure. And we don't want to just give students problems, but we also want to give them really conceptual explanations on how to do that type of problem. So every problem on Khan Academy, there's 100,000 problems right now, and we're adding more daily, have custom hints for that exact type of problem that hopefully get at the real heart of the learning. And as I said before, there's a lot of game mechanics, there's points, there's badges, and it's not just learning it one time for that week, it's also in the future to get real mastery. You have to show that you know it later, that you know it in a mixed context environment. What we find really exciting is we're starting to be able to do things that you could have never done in education before. There's a lot of amazing research out there, but it would have been hard to test it on groups of, frankly, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions. But we can do that now. We have 3 million exercises done every day. And this is just one of those examples. How many of you are familiar with Carol Dweck's work at Stanford? So a few of you. So her research is around growth mindsets. Really the idea that it's better to give people feedback on their effort and perseverance than on their innate ability. And the theory is when you praise someone on their innate ability, on their IQ or their intelligence, that's great. But then when they start to engage in something where they don't feel smart, because they're afraid of losing that praise, they'd rather disengage than persevere. But if you praise perseverance, then that's what's going to be reinforced. But we saw that if you put growth mindset type headers at the top of the exercises while the students are doing it, things like your brain is like a muscle, the more you flex it, the more powerful it gets. It saw a 4% increase in the problems done. And this was with a sample of, I think it was 40,000 students. So it was a highly statistically significant result. And as we speak, we're probably running 20 experiments along the same lines. This is a dashboard that kind of encapsulates, and there's a bunch of this stuff if someone's a coach or a teacher to use, but encapsulates how we imagine Khan Academy being used in a classroom. We started with a pilot here in Los Altos. They've since expanded. We're now used in over 30,000 classrooms around the world. But the general idea that we try to promote is, now that lectures and problem sets can happen at a student's own time and pace, let's free up class time to actually have more human interaction. And so in a dashboard like this, each row is the student in the class. Each column is one of those concepts that you saw in that knowledge map. And a teacher can see it in real time, how proficient his or her students are. And you see one student right over there is red and multiplying decimals. And so the teacher could see that, either do a direct intervention with that student or get one of the other students who've already proficient to tutor their peer. And frankly, build a skill that's more important than the math itself, but the communication and the empathy. This is some data from a local charter school in Oakland Unity. They're serving a very underserved population. A lot of these kids coming several grade levels behind when they join this ninth grade algebra class. But they've seen a pretty transformational result. And I want to stress the teacher here, because this isn't Khan Academy was dropped in and all of a sudden they saw these dramatic results. It's really about this teacher always wanting to move to a personalized direction, always wanting to have more human interaction, and really just needing the right tools so that they can do it at the full potential. But the results have been pretty dramatic. Peter McIntosh has actually written a book about this. 2011, before the class was really personalized, this was a ninth grade algebra class that was in the 7th percentile in California. And then the first year that they started piloting a model in this direction, and a lot of the credit goes to Peter McIntosh, most of the credit goes to Peter McIntosh, they moved to the 94th percentile in California. And now this past year, they moved to the 98th percentile. 7th percentile to 98th.
My name is Mark Howell.
So the next thing I want to show, we're excited about schools, but the one thing that we always remind ourselves is just how many people, and this is really still the bulk of our users, just have an incredible amount of potential, and they just need to tap into it. And this next video, at least in our minds, really highlights that.
My name is Mark Halberstadt. Growing up, I was really always a C student. I pretty much thought that the only thing I was good enough to do in college was major in music. But I sort of almost felt that it was more I was getting it because I was terrible at everything else. Really what I wanted to do was electrical engineering. And the last thing that I remember completely not getting was trig identities. So I went to YouTube and I did a search for trig identities, and the Khan Academy was the first thing that popped up. Watched a bunch of videos in the trig playlist to kind of get caught up to speed. I watched all the videos in the calculus playlist. I watched all the videos in the physics playlist. Watched a lot of videos on arithmetic. I took a leap and I decided to go back to school and went to Temple University, majored in electrical engineering, getting a second bachelor's. And keep in mind, I was really a straight C student growing up. And I just finished this year, first year back in college. I got a 4.0 GPA for the entire year. I got perfect scores on both of my Calc final exams and also on my chemistry final exam. I ended calculus, chemistry, both calculus classes, Calc 1, 2, and chemistry, with an average higher than 100%. There are some Khan Academy videos that I probably listen to the same concept over 20 or 30 times. And there is no tutor in the world I could have paid to have sat next to me and repeated the same thing over 20 or 30 times without at least them getting a little bit judgmental, or at least them getting thinking like, oh, well, this guy really is never going to get this concept and he should just give up. Where the understanding really happened was watching those videos and also working through the Khan Academy software and everything. The impact for me in my life, I really see it growing exponentially over the next 20 or 30 years. So, from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
So everything I've talked about so far has kind of been our world, the English-speaking world, the developed world. But you can imagine that it could have even larger implications in other places. And all of these are pictures of, for the most part, other not-for-profits taking Khan Academy and bringing them to different parts of the world. And they're all exciting stories, but probably the most amazing one is the one on the top right. I used to give talks like this and say, who knows, maybe one day this will be used in Mongolia. Just trying to think of the furthest place I could imagine. And then a few months later, I get an email from Mongolia. And so it's exciting, and it was an email, and then they had a YouTube link of a video. And so immediately I scan, I click on the video, I haven't fully read the email yet, and it was a very similar video to what you saw from Mark Halberstadt. It was from a young girl named Zaya, saying how she liked Khan Academy, etc. I thought it was pretty neat, but I said, oh, well, you know, clearly she must be middle class or upper middle class. Her English was quite good. She had access to YouTube and the internet. But then I read the text of the email, and it turned out that there was a group of engineers from Cisco Systems right over here who were using their vacation time to go to Mongolia and set up computer labs in orphanages. And what you see in the top right are the orphan girls using Khan Academy there, and Zaya was one of those orphan girls. And that by itself was pretty incredible, but what made it even more amazing is that she's now 17 years old, she is now our number one producer of content in the Mongolian language. So she's become really the teacher of her. And to get an idea of what kind of an international Khan Academy looks like, and we just launched a fully Spanish Khan Academy last week, I'll show you this next montage.
Sí, decimos que bueno, esta fue la primera cara y esta fue la segunda cara.
तो ये जो है जो observer यहाँ कहीं बैठा होगा तो उसको ये image जो है
那个角就是正弦数值对应的角
Мы можем обе стороны разделить на B плюс A.
Également sur la dernière leçon,
יש נקודה בשאלה. אז למעשה, זה רק השינוי בערך Y.
אכן,
דוי קרבון יוקטו אסיטל קוי ותפון נוהי.
Auf die Zahlengrade zeichnen. Hier ist meine Zahlengrade.
Mas é claro que ele fez muitas e muitas e muitas outras coisas importantes.
I'm Zaya from Mongolia. Your videos are so interesting and funny. Make more lessons.
And just to get an idea, and I encourage any of y'all who are interested, go to es.khanacademy.org to see the Spanish site that we just launched. This is what it looks like. It's not just the videos, although those have been translated, but also all of the exercises, everything, which obviously has hopefully powerful implications for 450, 500 million folks, many of whom live in this country. So now you could actually have the same classroom where folks are doing English and doing the same mathematics in Spanish, and we can start to address the issue that you shouldn't be held back in mathematics just because you haven't learned English yet. But, you know, a big picture, and I tell this to the team, and many of them are here, the team at Khan Academy all the time, this isn't just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I generally think this is a once-in-a-millennium opportunity to take this thing called education that has historically been scarce, historically been the key determinant between the haves and the have-nots, and at least start to address it in a more equitable way. so that, and it's not going to happen overnight. There's a lot of issues to address, and I'm sure we'll be able to address a lot. Think about these in the Q&A. But over the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years, we can take this thing that used to be scarce and expensive called education, and like clean drinking water or shelter, turn it into a fundamental human right. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Shake hands. We hug.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, yeah.
My name is Nineveh Caligari. I'm the co-founder of 826 Valencia in San Francisco, and I'm also now the founder and president of the Teacher Salary Project, and our mission is to change what it means to be a teacher in our country. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to see everybody, and also the Khan Academy team should raise their hand. He has
stand up.
Hello, they're here. The people who are doing it are here. I have the incredible honor of getting to chat with you and also to moderate a conversation among 500 of all of us together. So that's my job. I will start by saying that I really enjoyed your book. I agree with you. I laughed.
That's high praise from you guys.
Yes, it is. It's tough. It's tough from me, especially. I laughed and I actually cried 3 times.
Oh, wow.
And you said in your book that you worked well when you worked in a closet. And I just was wondering if you went back to a closet to write your book.
It wasn't in a closet, but yeah, I did. You know, I had a little office in downtown Mountain View on Castro Street, and it was right above that tea shop, the Chinese tea shop that's mm-hmm. there. And it was kind of like a closet. It was somewhat isolated, and I still I'm actually kind of introverted when I want to do things, I still try to spend at least half of my day in isolation.
Alone? Did you give yourself a writing schedule, or did you write from like 4 to 7 a.m. like poets do, or?
It went in fits and spurts. I did kind of a big, you know, kind of just brain purge. I got it all down, and then started to edit from there. And I had a lot of folks, you know, family, friends, everyone who was giving a lot of good feedback. And then, and I think it was much more in fits and spurts because obviously I was working on Khan Academy at the same time. But there were like periods of 2-3 weeks at a time where that was what I was doing. And then I would switch gears and, you know, let people give me feedback, et cetera, and then move back into it a few months later.
You talk about in the book that people are fearful of technology. Parents and schools are fearful. And I think people will be really relieved to hear that in your ideal school, kids are concentrating and spending that time alone only the fifth of the time. Yeah. So what are you saying that they're going to do the rest of the time? What exciting things do you have in mind for them?
Yeah, well, you know, stuff like that market simulation that I was talking about with the middle school kids. It's actually a very good game. I had one kid invent shorting on his own. It was very impressive. No, but in all seriousness, it's when people think of technology in classrooms, they immediately imagine the Borg or the Vulcans and kids doing questions all day and not getting any social interaction. And I view it as a complete opposite thing. That the technology, it can be a powerful tool, but it by itself isn't going to solve all the problems. It has to be integrated in a mindful way. And to us, it's about allowing the curriculum to be personalized around the student, allowing them to work at their own pace, master concepts, facilitate peer-to-peer interactions, arm teachers with data so that the teacher can spend most of his or her time interacting with students, working one-on-one with them, and also freeing up class time. So class time is now not about the lecture. It's not about fingers on your lips. It's not about grading homework. It's about doing simulations, doing games, having conversations about things. And this isn't a new idea. This is, you know, humanities seminars have been doing this for thousands of years, actually, if you go back to the ancient Greeks. You know, people would do a reading, and then they would have a conversation when they get there. Unfortunately, STEM, even today, is not normally taught that way. It's normally a lecture, and people take notes, and they get some homework, and then they get gaps in their knowledge. So when I imagine the school of the future, It really is about most of a kid's day. And, you know, there's a school that we recently got a video where they're using Khan Academy. I encourage people to look it up, Acton Academy in Austin, Texas, where you look at that, most of the kid's day, they're doing drama, they're doing writing, they're doing poetry, they're building robots. But they're using tools like Khan Academy to do some of their core skills so that also doesn't fall through the cracks and they can make sure that the kids are progressing there as well. So, yeah, absolutely. I think technology actually, somewhat ironically, can make a classroom more human than not having the technology at all.
Well, I think I forgot to say in my introduction, I'm a former public school teacher, and when I taught 146 students, it was really difficult to get a quick sense of how everybody was doing. So the teacher dashboards really excite me. It just would be so exciting to get that feedback constantly and to know so you can troubleshoot. It's amazing. My daughter is actually here tonight, and her question for you is, do you practice, or do you just... I guess with Nadia, it would be different. When you started with Nadia, it might be one thing. But today, when you're doing these lectures, how do you practice to get ready for your video?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. And I think it was a blessing that I started with Nadia, that I just, you know, Bill Gates in 2004 had, you know, somehow descended on me and told me, hey, make some videos.
Yeah.
I would have said, oh, boy, I've got to over-engineer this thing. I've got to make sure, I've got to hire James Earl Jones to do the voiceover.
Makeup.
I've got to make
whatever,
you know,
camera,
lights and 3D animations and all the rest. And I think it was a blessing that I started with Nadia, and I literally just think, well, what's the simplest thing that I think will work? And I was able to work with her over the phone where she didn't see me. We only saw each other's writings. I was like, well, can I recreate that? And it was easier because I didn't have to worry about, you know, combing my hair or plucking my eyebrows. I don't pluck my eyebrows, as you can tell. But I could just focus on the content. And I got that feedback that they really liked it. They liked it that it was, you know, I think a lot about what I want to say, but once I start saying it, it's
natural.
It's hopefully natural or more extemporaneous. And so as Khan Academy's grown, it has become a little more, oh, you know, a million people might watch this video, or I got to get this right, or what if there's an error in it? Boy, that's, to kind of get over that paralysis, I try to convince myself, well, let me just do a practice run. No one's going to watch this video. Let me just do a practice run. But I do a lot of preparation to make sure my mind, I've done the research, I have a clear idea of the concept myself, how I would visualize it. Then I make the video, and, you know, a lot of times that practice run, I was like, you know, that kind of works. And I'll use it. Sometimes I was like, no, that didn't work, and I'll do other versions.
I really loved in the book, I hope everybody reads the book, but I loved in the book how you really dug in and talked a lot about mastery learning and how, and it was true for me when I was teaching, you know, you cover the Industrial Revolution, you're moving on to how that impacted the World War I, and maybe some kids didn't quite get the Industrial Revolution well enough to really dive into the next topic. I love that. And then at the end of the book, you pal your reader with, and then we're going to throw away grades. So you go from, which is awesome, you go from we really want them to know to this large, huge vision of no grades. So tell us more about what your dream vision is in terms of what schools will look like.
Yeah, and I could go for hours on this. I could even write a book about it.
She's only giving us a couple more minutes.
You're right. You know, once again, it kind of, you know, the alternative mastery learning kind of seems silly, that you would learn something superficially and then move on to a more advanced topic, and you have this weaker and weaker foundation. And in a world of mastery learning, it grades, you know, you should get feedback. Like, I could say you got a B, but the B doesn't mean, oh, you're kind of above average but not the best student. A B should mean keep working on it.
Totally.
Become a better student. So you should still get a lot of feedback, and it should be at a very high standard, and we try to do that at Khan Academy. But the idea of that you should get a C or a B, and that's some type of a statement on your intellect or your ability, is kind of a silly statement. So, you know, for our team, when we say no grades, and a lot of people, when they hear no grades, they think this is like some touchy-feely hippie experiment of some kind.
I don't like those either.
No. Well, on some level, you know, and it's funny. Well, I've always used to think that when I used to talk about, when I used to hear people, oh, I have a school with no grades, and I didn't really get what they were saying. What they were saying is that they didn't want to hold people to a high standard. They absolutely wanted to hold people to a high standard, but this idea that you should just leave people with the gaps and then let them move on. So I say get a lot of feedback, but master concepts, and your real transcript is going to be the things that you showed mastery in. Your real transcript is going to be your portfolio of creative works, your writing, your computer programs, your art, and your real transcript is going to be the feedback from your peers of how good of a peer tutor were you, how good of a mentor were you, how good of a communicator are you.
I think it's really important. And also, there's a lot of elements of social justice in your book, because Saul talks a lot about who has the advantages to figure out how to master, how to get themselves into these elite colleges that then we value very much. And you talk about when you're getting a job, there's the simple resume test. Do you want me to say, in his book, he talks about how, you know, simply just by having an elite college on your resume, you're more likely to even get the interview, but it doesn't necessarily reflect all the talent that's left in the recycle bin. And so it's very, very painful, and it's really exciting to think about your notion of people getting certificates for content mastery and then being able to show that. It's so democratic and exciting.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club, and tonight's guest is Sal Khan, founder of the Khan Academy. My name is Zinaveh Caligari, and I am this evening's moderator. Sir Ken Robinson's famous talk is about how schools kill creativity. You talk a lot about creativity, and I know near the end of the book you say that it could be difficult to teach, but what are the right circumstances to make it ripe to have more creativity blossom?
Yeah, and I think creativity is one of those things that it's even though, you know, there's, I don't think there's a formula for teaching it, I think there's definitely things that you can do to avoid suppressing it. And, you know, you go to any four-year-old, five-year-old, they have a raw creativity. They have a raw curiosity. And a lot of what happens in a traditional model, and, you know, the teachers don't intend to do this, but it's the model that they are also a part of, which is, you know, classroom management, kids have to be quiet, they learn to follow orders, they have to take notes, do it exactly to kind of a preordained goal. That's the opposite of creativity. So I think the best environments are one where you have free-form environments, where kids have time. You know, creativity is oftentimes the byproduct of boredom even. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, especially even communities out here in Silicon Valley, kids are scheduled where every minute of their day, and that actually goes against creativity. You need time to just have a blank piece of paper, play with it. You need time to just write for writing's sake and come up with whatever you want, share it with your friends. And I think you can foster it if you create a community of creative folks, a lot of what y'all are doing at 826 Valencia. And that's what I think school should be all of the time.
I would love, one of my dreams for America would be that every adult who has a passion would be doing that passion alongside a young person and solving problems together. I feel like the world would be a much better place.
And the thing is that the current model actually makes it hard for that. Even if there's a student who has retained that and gets excited about something, oh, I have an idea for a business, or mm-hmm. I want to write a novel, they can't. Because they have tonight's homework, they have the AP test, they have whatever, the assembly line is moving on, so they can't get off of it. And what we think is exciting about a mastery-based model, about a personalized model, hey, all of a sudden you got excited about writing a novel, take a month off, try it. You want to start a business, take a month off, try it. If you fail, that's okay too. This is a time to try it out.
I'm scanning through questions, and you're getting a lot of thank yous.
Oh, you're welcome.
Which is a thank you from a mom. There's a couple thank yous from teachers. And then there's one that says, how should teachers change what they do in the classroom?
So, you know, I think it's different for every teacher. I think every circumstance is different. They all have different resources. But, you know, I think the general rule of thumb is try to gauge when kids are in the classroom, what percentage of that class time are the kids actively doing something that's engaging at their level, and how many minutes they're doing that. And try to optimize that. You know, if I'm in writing class, instead of me lecturing about writing, I want them to be writing, reading, giving them each other feedback. Minimize the amount that I'm the center of attention. If it's computer programming, same thing. Work on stuff, give each other feedback. If it's math class, peer tutoring, work on stuff. If you have tools like Khan Academy, if you have computers, every student can start working at their own pace. So that's my general notion is the main ratio, student to teacher ratio is important, but what's even more valuable, and this is actually more in the control of a teacher, is student to valuable time with the teacher ratio. So as a teacher, how much of my time is next to students, forming bonds, forming connections?
One comment I wanted to make that I loved about your book was you talked a lot about teachers collaborating, and I just want to say personally, when I taught by myself, I found it. Thank you for realizing and acknowledging how isolating it can be. And when I team taught, one thing that I wanted to share with you is when I team taught, we didn't have double the ideas. We had 10 times, 20 times the ideas. And I love that you knew that. How did you learn that?
Well, you know, I mean, it's you know, I've not been a formal teacher, mm-hmm. But I've done a lot of informal teaching, and it was, and especially because I was able to compare it to other things that I've done in life.
Well, in the closet teaching that you
well,
did,
in the
also,
that was very isolating.
You were alone.
Actually, in some ways, it wasn't because people were able to give me feedback and understand what I was doing. But you know, when I was at the hedge fund, I had colleagues I could bounce yeah. ideas off. I would get feedback from. When I used to work in tech, obviously it was incredibly collaborative. And whenever I would teach something, it's like, oh, I don't know what everyone's thinking. I don't know if I'm doing a good job. Maybe there's other ideas here. And it was also, there's kind of a single point of failure. If I didn't have a good day that day, then it was hard. My energy level wasn't fully there. And as soon as you get more people in the room, different teachers will connect with different students in different ways along different subject. It just becomes a much more of a vibrant environment.
It's a lot richer. I agree. Somebody in the audience wants to know how Khan Academy can help college kids.
How it can help college kids? Well, you know, it's obviously a resource out there for anyone to use. I've chatted with several of y'all before this session. It sounds like some of your children are already using it. They can look up stuff, especially in STEM subjects, science, math. We have a lot of videos, a lot of exercises. You know, the math is already going into calculus on the exercise side. On the video side, it goes well into differential equations, multivariable, chemistry, physics, which are really, once again, these are the subjects when people have trouble with the graduate level course in physics, it's usually because they're weak in the foundation. If it's a graduate level course in math, it's usually because they're weak in the foundation. So I would recommend this for any student trying to make sure that they're really deeply understanding the subject matter.
You have a sixth grader in the audience who wants to know, how do I find the right math level for me?
How do you find the right level math level for you? And this is actually a really important
point. I
wonder
where they are.
Oh,
where
yeah.
Are
Where's
you? Who are you?
Sixth graders.
Oh, she's in the back.
Oh,
he's
okay.
In the back. Hello.
Oh,
wonderful.
So the right math level. So this is something we've got a lot of feedback from. We had a lot of resources, but how do you actually find the right thing for you? And that's why we introduced that pretest on Khan Academy. Mm-hmm. So if you log in, you take the pretest. That's going to try to understand what you know and don't know and then start recommending the right level for you. And then in the next few months, you're going to see something on Khan Academy called missions. And those missions, there's going to be a sixth grade mission, a seventh grade mission, an AP calculus mission, eventually a physics and a chemistry mission. And if that's your goal, maybe one day an SAT mission, you pick that as your goal. Hey, I'm a sixth grader. I want to learn sixth grade Common Core. It will start you in that. But then if it sees that you're having trouble, it'll back you up and say, well, okay, you're having trouble with exponents. Let's make sure you understand multiplication. Let's make sure you understand something else. So you can get to your level, but it'll also be personalized.
That is really cool.
Hopefully.
It will be awesome. One thing I was talking to your team earlier at the reception is that what's so exciting about your work is that you have been so successful and you guys are only going to be more successful. You know, you're just going to get better and come up with more incredible ideas. Anyway, I don't really need to butter you up anymore.
No, I don't mind.
You don't mind. I have a personal thank you. As you know, with the Teacher Salary Project, since 2003, I've been working to try and convince Americans to double good teacher salaries because I think it's really critical. So in your book, yay, it's really important, our economy and our democracy, the future of all of our well-being. So thank you in your book for talking about that. And I'm just wondering why this is so obvious to you and to me, and why, what hurdles do you think we're going to have to get there? And I know I heard you the other day with Arne Duncan. Yeah. You were interviewing him, and he was talking about the North Carolina teachers on food stamps. You know, how bad does it have to get before we're going to really do something?
Well, and, you know, and the one thing that, you know, even when I was writing the book, that I started to say, wow, you know, it's one of the things teachers should make more money, but the initial reaction is, well, that's not practical. There's budget constraints and all that. But if you actually do the back of the envelope calculation, there's plenty of resources. The state of California, which is lower than, you know, New York, spends $18,000 per student per year. California averages around $7,000 or $8,000 per student a year. But even $8,000 per student per year times 30 students, that's $240,000. The fully loaded cost of a teacher does not even get close to being half of that.
Right.
And so the question is where is all of those other, you know, the real estate doesn't cost anywhere near that. To get, you know, 1,000 square foot of decent space doesn't cost anywhere near that. So where is that money going? And, you know, I've talked to some folks in policy, and they told me that actually about half the money of that 8,000 goes to even the school level. So half of it is just getting lost in kind of overhead in bureaucracy, when I think all of us could agree that if we're spending on education, I can't imagine a world where a rational world would be 90% of that goes to the classroom, goes to the resources, goes to the teacher. And, you know, and I want to make it clear, this isn't even just public schools. It's also private schools. I mean, private schools.
Well, they'll follow, yeah.
They have to, but it's this inefficiency is true across the system. You know, private schools could be $20,000, $30,000 per student per year. There's maybe 15 or 20 kids in a room, but it's still several hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the teachers aren't getting paid any significant fraction of that.
I agree. I think we need a major systemic change. Thank you for using your power to get that out there. I really appreciate it. And I think talking about cutting testing costs and administrative costs and turnover costs are all really important. But I want to move on. You know, historically, the summer vacation was meant to provide farmers with free labor for the harvest. It's obviously not relevant. Mm. I think we're pretty well-liked people, but right now I'm about to agree with you 1,000%. What's your vision for summer?
So summer, and I write this in the book, that I think it's ridiculous because that we take time off. We have all of these unutilized assets. We have these schools, these fields, we have these professionals, these teachers, the students, and where they could be engaged and they could continue to learn. And you know, the initial reaction when I say that is like, oh, you're like, you know, Scrooge McDuck or something. You know, that was my best memories were from summer. Summer was when I got to be creative. Summer was when I got to think about things and had time. And what I stress is, no, all of your life should be like that. The full year should be about creativity and openness and doing open-ended projects. And that should just continue through the year. So I think, you know, two of the very kind of obvious things is, it's crazy that school ends at 3 o'clock when most parents come home at 5. Once again, it should not be another 2 hours of fingers on your lips and doing that. It should be another 2 hours of open-ended creativity, of engaging with each other, of playing games, doing simulations. And that should just continue year-round. And if your family is lucky enough, you know, let's say I'm invited to speak in Mexico City, and I think that's an incredible experience for my kid. You know, in the traditional model, it's like, oh, no, they have a test tomorrow. They can't come with me. Even though that experience would have been way more memorable for them. In this type of a model, because everyone's learning at their own pace, you can go. You can go. You can even do some work while you're traveling. And then when you come back, you just re-engage into the community.
Until you master what you need to know.
Until you've mastered what you need to know and more.
Well, and also in the book you talk about the social justice issue of kids unlearning things and how intense it is for middle-class kids, but especially for low-income kids. It's so important. You got 3 degrees while you were at MIT, and you didn't go to class. Tell us about that.
Yes. So
you wrote it.
And I'll do my caveat. I loved MIT. It's a great institution, amazing place. But I think the one thing that I started to really appreciate in college is the main learning wasn't happening in the lecture hall with 100 kids or 200 kids with, you know, someone lecturing. At least it didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. I found if I took that same time and I experimented in the computer lab or I went to the library with the textbook, you know, a textbook, it's a primitive self-learning tool. And unfortunately, you know, it's the only way to self-learn before a lot of these new technologies come around. And if you look at people who've done well versus haven't done well, the best indicator is, are they able to kind of read fairly dense textbooks? Mm-hmm. But I did find that I was getting much more productivity of my own time, spending time with the textbook, doing problems as much as possible, working with peers, going to the computer lab or the laboratory and playing with some of the ideas. And I found that when I did that and exam time came around, you know, a lot of folks who IQ-wise could eat my lunch, you know, they were cramming and they didn't really pick up a lot during the term. While, you know, because I'd been engaged with the content in a very active way, it felt much more natural come exam time, and I probably remembered more of it.
And you were controlling your own destiny and owning the things. It's really exciting to hear you talk about that. We only have time for a couple more questions, but I want to lead you in with this one. At the end of the book, you talk about your vision for a different alternative college, and one of the audience members asked, students need practical real-world experience. What's your point of view on that?
Absolutely. And, you know, and I, as I write in the book, the ideal college, and there's a few universities, and, you know, the most famous of which some of y'all might be familiar with is Waterloo. It's kind of, you know, the preeminent engineering school in Canada. And they spend most of their time in the field. In fact, right now, this fall, if you were to go to most companies in Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, even Khan Academy, anywhere, most of the college interns, in fact, almost all of the college interns right now will be from Waterloo. Because the Stanford students, the MIT students, the Harvard students are in a lecture hall right now. They're, you know, taking notes and studying for an exam, while the Waterloo students really have a monopoly on real-world experience, and they go back and forth, and they spend 60% of their time doing internships, the rest of the time on campus. And these students, when they leave Waterloo, I've talked to several of them, usually end up not with debt, but savings, because they're doing these great internships. They end up with multiple job offers, and you know, anyone who feels that this is somehow skewing their education in terms of, you know, they're not getting much of the kind of the intellectual activity, they should just meet these young people. I mean, I would argue they're more mature because they spent more time working alongside mentors and all the rest, understanding the world. They've had more exposure to more organizations. They're in a position to make better decisions about their future because they've sampled oftentimes 6-7 different organizations across many fields. They could experiment. And I think that model, there's no reason why it shouldn't be replicated in almost any field. If you want to work in finance, you should spend a significant fraction of your time in that part of the world. If you want to work in biology, you should be in labs. You should be experimenting. You should see whether you really like it. I absolutely think, you know, that's the kind of college I hope my children get to go to.
I was really inspired too, and I was daydreaming about my kids in the future in those kinds of settings.
Especially
too.
Them having savings as opposed to debt.
Savings would be great. Yes, savings would be great. But the college debt, you know, the president right now is really focused on that right now too. I think college debt is another major, major problem. You talk about in the book, and then I'm going to ask you two more questions, and then that will be it.
Oh, no, I'm enjoying this.
Okay, good. Oh, yes. I'm glad. How's the interview going?
Oh,
I'm just
good.
Joking. Oh, yes. Good. Well, okay, good. You mention that there's research about how better behavior and better test scores have a direct correlation with time at the dinner table.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, in the book, there's a whole chapter. You know, there's always these homework debates and homework wars. Should there be more homework, less homework? And I cite in the book, any study where they tried to measure actual amount of homework found absolutely no correlation across countries between amount of homework and success.
Mm-hmm.
But what they have found correlates is having dinner with your family, huge indicator, and the other one is sleep. And both of those two things can very easily, and I think a lot of us, you know, when we were in high school, and if we have high school age kids, can testify, both of those things can often get squeezed out by homework. And so I definitely imagine, you know, I've talked about a year-round school, but you could, you know, take vacations as you need. It could be 9 to 5 or 8 to 5, but I kind of see that's your done. That's your learning time, mm-hmm. your creative time. The rest of your day, just as we all need it, it's your time to decompress, spend time with the family, continue to work on your creative projects, and not be up until 2 a.m. stressed about, you know, you haven't looked up 18 vocabulary words.
I think the homework is really serious, and I was just reading, you know, in South Korea, you mentioned in your book that in some cultures, the after-school tutoring, I'm sure everybody probably saw the article, the $4 million tutor, the after-school tutoring in some communities is where the real learning is happening. And so some kids in South Korea wear a pillow on their wrist so that they can sleep during class, which is just the most dramatic image. Class, nothing's happening there. So my great wish for you is more success, tremendous fulfillment.
And we have to localize into Korean fast.
Yeah.
I
wish for you a very long and incredibly healthy life. Thank you for allowing me to interview you. And your final question is, what is your great wish for American society, global society? Where do you hope this will all lead us?
You know, I'm genuine about this. You know, I always cite this. If you go 400 years in the past and you were to go to Western Europe and you were to see who could read, it was about 25% of the men and about 10 to 15% of the women. And at that point in history, if you were to find someone who knew how to read, or even someone who didn't know how to read, and you asked them what percentage of the population do you think is even intellectually capable of reading, they might have said maybe 30% or 40% if you give them a lot of training.
Yeah,
the rest of everyone, most people aren't capable of reading. And we now know that's completely false. We had public education, and now it's 99.9% in the developed world can read. I think there's an analogy for us even today, though. There are things today, you know, whether you say calculus or quantum physics or, you know, whatever it might be, there's a lot of things that people just say, well, that's not for everyone. Most people really can't get that. Or I'm not a math person, or I'm not a writer, or I'm not a, you know, whatever it might be. And I think that's just like 400 years ago, it's an artificial, some degree, culturally inflicted or self-inflicted barrier. And what I'd be very excited to see, and I hope everyone here believes me because I genuinely think this, that everyone here and everyone, frankly, on the planet is capable of understanding anything that any other human being can understand. And if we go another, hopefully it doesn't take 400 years, hopefully it takes 40 years or even shorter, if we get to a point that quantum physics is just something that everyone understands, relativity, whatever it might be, it could be a pretty exciting planet to live on. I think, you know, we could increase the order of magnitude, the number of people who could do cancer research, the number of people who could think about clean energy, the number of people who could think about all of these problems, and the whole rate of civilization could accelerate. So it's, you know, I think it's an exciting time to be alive.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want all these questions?
Yeah.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening's Innovating California program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Chevron. Again, we would like to thank Sal Khan, founder of the Khan Academy and author of The One World Schoolhouse, Education Reimagined. Nineveh Caligari, co-founder of 826 Valencia and president of the Teacher Salary Project, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and the web. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.